Omaha Public Radio presents a special luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a debate on the initiative which will appear on the Nebraska ballot on next Tuesday's general election, giving the voters the choice of restoring capital punishment in Nebraska or sustaining the legislature's action of May 2015, banning the death penalty in Nebraska. The participants will be Colby Koash, co-chairman of Retain a Just Nebraska, and Robert Evnen, co-founder of Nebraskans for the Death Penalty. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, September 15, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speakers is Gary Willis, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Today's forum deals with, should the ban on the death penalty be repealed by voters in November? The Nebraska unicameral passed LB 268, May 2015, banning the death penalty in the state of Nebraska. Governor Pete Ricketts vetoed the bill, but the legislature overrode his veto and it became law. Nebraskans for the death penalty gathered over 166,000 signatures to put the death penalty issue on the November ballot for Nebraskans voters to decide. The Omaha Press Club welcomes State Senator Colby Koash, co-chairman of Retain a Just Nebraska, and Robert Evnen, co-founder of Nebraskans for the Death Penalty today. Robert Evnen is an attorney that represents employees in labor and employment matters in Omaha, Lincoln, and throughout the state. He has an unpaid role with Nebraskans for the Death Penalty. He was appointed to the State Board of Education by Governor Heineman in 2005 and was elected in 2008. Senator Colby Koash has served in the Nebraska unicameral since 2009, and under his leadership, LB 268 passed, replacing the death penalty with life without parole in Nebraska. He has spoken to groups throughout Nebraska and around the country about his conversion away from supporting the death penalty. We have tossed a coin, and Senator Koash will present first.
I have about 20 pieces of paper here, and I promise I won't read them all. But thank you, Mr. Williams, for the nice introduction, and thank all of you for being here. This is an important issue, and it's an issue we're all going to have an opportunity to weigh into through our vote in November. And so I'm going to talk to you a little bit about my experience in the legislature, how the legislature got to where it is, where we are today, and the reasons I believe that we're here today. So the debate might be framed as, do we want to bring back the death penalty or not? Because that, in essence, is what the ballot language is going to say. Do you want to retain or repeal the legislature's action with regard to the death penalty? But I would say to you that this debate is really not about that, because we really haven't had the death penalty in almost 20 years. And that's the fact. The last execution that happened in Nebraska was in 1997. So next year will be the 20th year since Nebraska has had any capital punishment within its borders. So I want to talk to you a little bit what's happened in those last 20 years, because looking at the past is what got the legislature to where it is today. In the last 20 years since the last execution, in the 90s, then Attorney General Stenberg worked with the legislature, and they worked to try to shorten the appeals the best that they could, to shorten the length, the amount, the best that they could within the confines of the Constitution. And they were pretty successful in that effort, and I did one of these forums with former Attorney General Stenberg, and that was his comment, that he had worked with the legislature in the 90s to do that. And in that time, we've had governors who were supportive of the death penalty, attorney generals who have been supportive of the death penalty, and even a legislature who wouldn't have stood in the way. But regardless of that desire to do that, carry out capital punishment in the last 20 years, we haven't done it. In 2009 was my first year in the legislature. And it was kind of a a whirlwind, of course. As a new senator, you don't know all the issues that are going to get thrown in front of you as a new senator. And one of the first things that was put in front of me as a member of the Judiciary Committee, and the question I had to answer to just about everybody, media, constituents, my colleagues, was how are you going to vote on the death penalty? And in 2009, there was a bill brought to change the method of execution. Up until 2009, it was the electric chair, and a bill was brought forward to change the method from an electric chair to lethal injection. And we were told, as a legislature, the public was told, the citizens were told, that if the legislature would just change the method, if we would just move away from the electric chair, which at the time had been found unconstitutional, if we just change the method, then that would be the final barrier. Executions would take place post-haste following that bill becoming law. That was 2009, so we are now 8 years down the road, and that promise has not been fulfilled. So the legislature looked at that. They looked at the history, and they looked at what would need to happen. And it became very clear that even though the method had been changed, Nebraska would be unable to get the drugs. And in fact, our governor, a year ago, said, I will get the drugs, I will have them. A year has passed. He has not got them. The state of Nebraska wrote a check with your money. That check was cashed. The goods were not delivered. And where the man is that took that money, nobody knows. So that's the reality of it. So the legislature looked at this, and we looked at the history, and we said, wow, is 20 years enough? They've had their chance. People who want to see an execution have had their chance. There was very little standing in their way. I would remind you that in 2009, there wasn't even a filibuster on the bill to change the method. The legislature could not muster 17 votes in 2009 to launch a filibuster against changing the method. It sailed to the governor's desk. It was signed. And again, we were told that that was the last barrier. I wanted to go back to the drugs. We can't get them. We haven't got them. If it were possible to do this, I would ask you this. Do you think that the previous administrations, given that makeup, would have done it? There wasn't even an attempt. Because the reality was, those drugs were not going to come. So we now have people who had the sentence of death and have been sitting there, not for years, but for decades. And the legislature looked at that fact and they said, we said, as a body, 20 years is enough. We have better things to worry about. And we came to the conclusion that this was a broken system. And to fix government was in part our charge when the voters sent us to the Capitol. I remember campaigning and people say, what will you do if you become elected? And one of the things that I told them was, I'll look for government programs that aren't working, and if they're not working and I can't fix them, I'll get rid of them. And the death penalty seemed to meet that test, and I wasn't alone. 32 colleagues of mine saw it as a broken system as well. We thought about the cost. Now, there's been a lot of debate back and forth about the cost. Dr. Goss, a well-respected economist, put out a large figure a month or so ago. The Attorney General has disputed that cost. But we'll say this. Dr. Goss put out his methodology. He put out his sources. The Attorney General has not. The Attorney General is a sample of one. Dr. Goss is a trusted economist that the legislature relies on quite frequently, and he stands by his numbers. But if you don't believe the numbers, and I understand why people wouldn't, that's a big number. you can't deny that the cost of the death penalty is more than the alternative. So whatever number you're comfortable with, if you think it's just $1 million more, $1,000 more, whatever number you think it might cost, you have to ask yourself this question, because the legislature asked itself this question over and over again. Regardless of the cost, is the taxpayer getting what he or she paid for? We're putting the money out. We have zero return on that money. You may hear the idea that the death penalty deters crime. Well, I think the science has been fairly clear about that, that it doesn't deter crime. My 7-year-old understands deterrence. He understands that if he does something that requires punishment and I wait 20 years to do that, it's really not a punishment. If the death penalty were truly a deterrent, would Texas have any crime? Texas is leading the way here. But their murder rate is higher than ours. So in closing, let me say this. There are two scenarios that will occur at the end of the day after the vote is taken. Scenario one is the legislature's vote is upheld, and we can move on and invest whatever amount of money that we're spending in something that we're going to get a return on. Plenty of things that can be spent. At the very least, we could give that money back to the citizens. The second scenario is this. The legislature's action will be overturned. It'll be like it never happened. That doesn't mean we get the drugs. That doesn't mean that 10 people sitting on death row will all of a sudden get what's coming to them. All of those problems that the legislature looked at carefully, thoughtfully, deliberatively, all of those problems will remain the day after all of the votes are counted. And the legislature understood that, and we recognized capital punishment for what it was. It's a broken government program that was costing us money, and it is something that the state of Nebraska is better off without. Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon. I'm happy to be with you today. I appreciate the opportunity and the fact that the Omaha Press Club has chosen to hold a debate discussion about this very important issue that the voters of our state are going to be considering in November, or if you get an early ballot, in October. I want to just make one or two personal notes. The first is that I am today in the presence of Gary Kerr, who is someone who I watched on Channel 6. I want you all to know that Channel 6's signal comes in loud and clear in Lincoln, and I just very much appreciate being here with you today. I'm kind of an old TV radio guy. I've never anchored anything like that, but it's just terrific to be here, and I appreciate it. As was noted, I have served on the Nebraska State Board of Education. I served there for nearly 8 years. One of the things that people ask me is, well, why am I involved with this? And I guess as I reflect on it, it's because I view it as a continuation of my work protecting children and families. I want to begin by talking about why I support the death penalty. And I could distill it down to three primary reasons. The first is that it is a just punishment for the most heinous crimes committed by the most depraved criminals. We have to ask ourselves whether it's proper to hold people accountable for the horrific crimes that they choose to commit. We know that the sixth commandment is thou shalt not murder, which is thou shalt not take an innocent human life unlawfully or immorally. We know that the death penalty is referenced in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. And the thing here is that even though the death penalty, you know, in the world of the Old Testament, the ancient Hebrews didn't carry out the death penalty very often. It was rare, but it was there. It was on the books. And there was a very intense process before it was ever imposed on anyone. And that's the model that we use in our state, and that model is the right model, in my view. The death penalty affirms the value of innocent human life. And I want to talk about the process for a moment in Nebraska statutes. And, you know, we're talking about it's a just punishment. And I'll refer back for a moment to the prophet Micah. The prophet Micah wrote, it's a familiar verse, many of you will know it, what does God expect of you? He expects you to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly before your God. Well, what do these things mean? Doing justice, judging people honestly, loving mercy, considering mercy when you are about to impose a punishment. And what about walking humbly before your God? You better not be arrogant about it. You better not be haughty about it. It's serious business, and you ought to consider it such. What do we do in Nebraska? What do the statutes in Nebraska provide? In Nebraska, if a prosecutor is seeking the death penalty, the prosecutor has to say so up front and plead aggravating circumstances. Under Nebraska statutes, there are 9 aggravating circumstances. The prosecutor has to plead one or more of those in order to seek the death penalty. That's doing justice. That Nebraska statute also contains mitigating factors, a list of mitigating factors. There are 7 mitigating factors listed, the last of which is whatever else is considered to be in mitigation of the crime. This is where we have statutorily embraced mercy. What's the process for this? A jury has to decide unanimously that there are one or more aggravating circumstances in order to result in a sentence of death. If a jury finds that there are aggravating circumstances, then a 3-judge panel is convened, and the 3 judges take evidence on the question of mitigating factors. And after taking the evidence of mitigation, those 3 judges have to act unanimously. The death penalty cannot be imposed unless all 3 of those judges agree that it's appropriate in that case. That's the process we use, following which there are direct appeals and indirect appeals. Now, it's an involved process. Shouldn't it be? It ought to be. I don't think there's anything wrong with the fact that it's a more involved process when the end result could be a penalty of death. And as a result, we don't use it often, and we shouldn't use it often, and we reserve it, as we should, for the most heinous crimes that are committed by the most depraved criminals. So my first point in support of the death penalty is that it's a just punishment for a small number of crimes and criminals. The second is deterrence. There are many studies which demonstrate that the death penalty has a deterrent effect. The study that I refer to most often is a panel study that was conducted by a professor from Emory University and a professor from Clemson University. And these 2 professors published their findings in the American Law and Economics Review. This is a peer-reviewed journal. It's published by the Oxford University Press. The editors-in-chief are professors of law from Northwestern and the University of Texas. It's not an insignificant or insubstantial study. In it, they considered panel data, and what that means is that they looked at over 3,000 counties in the United States, and they studied those 3,000 counties over a 20-year period of time. That was their database. And they took their data and ran a multiple regression analysis on it. It's as deep into the weeds as I'm going to get today. What they found is that there is a strong deterrent effect, not only to the death penalty, that is carrying out the penalty, but there is a deterrent effect from issuing a sentence of death. Well, by their estimate, at least 8 innocent lives are saved by the imposition of a sentence of death from its deterrent effect. The death penalty, when it's imposed, saves, by their analysis, at least 8 innocent lives. This study was then taken up by a couple of law professors from the University of Chicago, who published an article in the Stanford University Law Review. And the theme of their article, the question is capital punishment morally required? In other words, if we know, or if we have good reason to believe, that the death penalty saves innocent human lives, then isn't it the case that it's not just morally permissible, it's morally required, because we have good reason to believe that without it, innocent human lives will be lost? That's the theme of their article. I think it's compelling. It was cited in a Supreme Court opinion last year. Colby said that it doesn't deter crime, that there are studies that show that it doesn't deter crime. I have never seen a study that says that the death penalty doesn't deter crime. I've seen a variety of studies that talk about the intensity of the effect of deterrence. I've never seen a study that says, we can tell you definitively it doesn't deter. Death penalty opponents have been generally pretty careful about that. They don't claim that there's evidence that it doesn't deter. What they do is critique studies that say that it does deter. And that's where they've focused their efforts. So the second, if you wait 20 years, is it a deterrent? Well, we ought not to be waiting 20 years. That's longer than we ought to wait. But I will tell you that if I'm sitting and the possibility is that a sentence of death is going to be imposed upon me, that effect lasts a long time. You know, would Texas have any crime? It isn't a question of whether what Texas crime rate is compared to somebody else's crime rate. The question is, what would Texas crime rate be without it? That's the way you look at this, if you want to look at it in some sort of a methodologically reliable fashion. So the evidence, there is strong evidence that we have good reason to believe that the death penalty has a deterrent effect, and if it does, then that makes the moral case for the death penalty. The third reason why I support it is that we must protect those who protect us. We send people out on a thin blue line every day in this city, in other cities, corrections officers. They're out there every day risking their lives to protect us. Law enforcement overwhelmingly supports the death penalty. And it's not too hard to understand why. Consider a prison guard who works among prisoners who've been convicted and sentenced to life. If they've been sentenced to life and that's the most they're going to be sentenced to, what have they got to lose by taking out a prison guard? Law enforcement overwhelmingly supports the death penalty. I want to give you an illustration of this that my friend Sheriff Rick Eberhardt, who is here from Pierce County, brought to my attention some time ago, and that is that in the Tecumseh riots, you recall that there was a riot in the Tecumseh prison last year. And in that riot, the inmates were able to hold captive 2 prison guards. Now, they killed 2 of their own, But they did not harm those prison guards. And the question that I would ask you is why? This is the reason why law enforcement, it certainly informs the reason why law enforcement is so overwhelmingly supportive of the death penalty. And we ask those people to go out and risk their lives for us every day. We ought to give them this protection that they think is important. That means a lot to me. Now, I want to turn for a few minutes to the claims that have been made by death penalty opponents. One of the interesting things is that Colby and I had lunch together yesterday also in Lincoln, where we debated the death penalty at the Lincoln Independent Business Association. And one of the questions that one of the news reporters asked him was, if we fixed everything tomorrow so that you could carry it out, would that be satisfactory to you? Would you support it? And his answer was no. I'm opposed to the death penalty. So what that suggests to me is that we have all these issues that are being raised, but they're not really the reasons. Well, I've tried to give you my reasons, but I'm also now going to try to at least deal with these issues that have been raised. One of the things that's been talked about is that life means life. That is, the alternative to the death penalty is life imprisonment. There's no such thing as life imprisonment. And the illustration of that, I'll give you an illustration of that in our state. 3 years ago, there was an inmate who had been sentenced to life in prison. He had been convicted of murder. He and another guy beat somebody to death, was sentenced to life in prison. He was 70 years old. And the Pardons Board, which is composed of the governor, the attorney general, and the secretary of state, the Pardons Board voted to commute his sentence to a term of years. Now, the Pardons Board in Nebraska is enormously powerful. There is no review of any decision made by the Pardons Board. There's no court review. They have enormous power with respect to sentences. They can pardon people. They can commute sentences. They can commute it to time served. They can commute it to a term of years. They have enormous power. They commuted this inmate's time, and that made him eligible for parole. Within a month, he was paroled. And within several months after that, he sexually assaulted a 10-year-old girl. He was 70 years old. He was let out, even though he'd been sentenced to life. He was let out. And within a year, he was back in prison, this time for molesting a 10-year-old girl. That's an example of why life doesn't mean life. It's not an accurate statement. There's another reason why it's not accurate, and that is that lawyers are going in and arguing the following to our courts. Life without parole itself is unconstitutional. They're arguing that it's unconstitutional as a violation of cruel and unusual punishment, the prohibition against that under our federal constitution. And earlier this year, they argued that it was a violation of our state constitution. There was a case that was decided by the Nebraska Supreme Court this year where the argument was made by a guy who had been sentenced to life that you could not have a sentence of life, that was unconstitutional under Nebraska's constitution, and that he had to be sentenced to a term of years and be given an opportunity to be paroled. The Supreme Court rejected that. What I want to suggest to you is that the idea that if we just get rid of the death penalty, we'll have life imprisonment and that'll be the end of it is not an accurate way of looking at the situation we're in. There will be continuing arguments that life should not mean life, that a life sentence is itself unconstitutional. You have the Ernie Goss study says it's $14.6 million a year. Everyone I talk with in law enforcement or in the justice system, I asked them, where did you spend $14.6 million additional last year for the death penalty? Where have you spent it additional this year for the death penalty? And they all just shrug their shoulders and kind of chuckle. Ernie Goss's number is a statistical construct, but I haven't found anybody who's actually involved in law enforcement in Nebraska who's told me that it is remotely close to anything accurate. But even if it were accurate, what does it amount to? Well, it's the cost of a matinee movie ticket for everybody in the state. That's what it comes out to per capita. You couldn't even go to a movie at night It's a matinee movie ticket. So the question I would ask, that even if Ernie Goss's number is correct, which I believe it is not, is it worth the cost of a matinee movie ticket? And, you know, I think Colby's primary point is that even if it costs nothing, we don't carry it out. The system is broken. We're not getting our money's worth. There's no closure for the victims. This is like your teenage kid putting a dent in your car, coming home and telling you that you should junk the car. No, let's fix it. We should fix it. 8 years ago, the Nebraska Supreme Court said no to the electric chair. At that time, there were two inmates who were close to the point of having an execution date set. Their dates were being set. And at the time that that happened, the Supreme Court said, stop, we're not going to let you use the electric chair. So we were about to carry it out with respect to two inmates. Now, in the intervening 8 years, we've switched to lethal injection. The lethal injection protocol that the state of Nebraska set is the same thing as the federal protocol. That seemed reasonable, logical. We're going to set what the federal government does. And yet, the federal government has stopped Nebraska from importing those drugs. That's an interesting contradiction. That's sort of an academic way of putting it. But the federal government itself has sentenced the Boston bomber to death and is seeking the death penalty against the shooter who went into the church in South Carolina. So the difficulties in obtaining the drugs are not the fault of our state. It's due to the interference of the federal government. But that isn't an unsolvable problem. The point being that what I am hoping is that in November that the voters of Nebraska, 166,000 of them signed a petition to put this on the ballot, and I am hoping that a substantial majority of Nebraskans will vote to repeal the repeal. If you want to keep the death penalty on the ballot, you have to vote to repeal the repeal. And then after that, that the unicameral will get the message that we have to do something to improve this system. Other states carry it out. Ours can too, if we turn our attention to it. But then you have the question of whether we're getting our money's worth. This is, it isn't of any value to us. We haven't carried out any executions in 20 years. It's of no value to us. Well, I want to tell you about Candace Harms. Do you remember Candace Harms? Candace Harms was a co-ed at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. She was abducted from her parents' driveway by Roger Bjorklund and Scott Barney. They threw her in the trunk of the car. They hauled her all around the city. She was brutally raped. She was sexually tortured. Ultimately, she was strangled. And then she was shot. She was thrown in a field. Then they went back. She was still alive. So Bjorklund emptied a .38 caliber handgun into her, and she died. They dug a shallow grave and buried her in a field southeast of Lincoln. She was missing for months. Finally, the police apprehended Barney and Bjorklund on an unrelated crime. Barney got concerned that Bjorklund would rat him out. So Barney, understanding that this was a capital crime that they'd committed, confessed to the crime of which he was guilty and told law enforcement the location of her body. He was sentenced to life. He made a deal and got life. Bjorklund was tried and sentenced to death. Now, if we had not had the death penalty on the books, then Candace Harms' family would never have been able to give her remains a proper burial. She would be missing to this day. Her family would not know where she was. Her family would not know what had happened to her. It's because we had the death penalty on the books that Candace Harms' family was able to get some closure and give her a proper burial. I give you one other example. Sergio Martinez Perez, raped and beat to death a 93-year-old woman in Omaha. He beat her so badly there was blood on all the walls and on the ceiling of the murder scene. He pleaded guilty to that crime, of which he was guilty, in exchange for the prosecutor not seeking the death penalty against him, which, by the way, saved the cost of a first-degree murder trial, saved the cost of most appeals, because he pleaded guilty. That's because we have the death penalty on the books. There are other examples. I think I've gone on long enough. So let me conclude by saying this, and then we'll take questions. I hope that, having considered the issue, that you will vote to keep the death penalty. In order to keep the death penalty, vote repeal. You have to vote on our confusing ballot on this. You have to vote repeal to repeal what the legislature did. To keep the death penalty, you vote to repeal. And so I want to thank you all for being here. I'd also like to introduce Vivian Tuttle. Vivian Tuttle's daughter was one of the murder victims in the Norfolk bank murders. And if you want to know how victims' families feel about the death penalty, I would just point out to you that Vivian herself personally went around the state and collected thousands of signatures on the petitions to put this back on the ballot. So, Vivian, I'm very glad you're able to be here today. Thank you. I want to thank the Omaha Press Club, and we'll be happy to take questions.
The first question we have is, what about the argument that innocent people have been put to death under the death penalty? I guess, Robert, if you'd care to address that, both of you.
Sure. There's no claim by opponents of the death penalty that anyone on death row today is innocent. There's no claim in Nebraska. Now, you'll hear claims, you know, that other people were on death row and were exonerated. There are people across the country who have been on death row and were exonerated. Their count is 156. But not in Nebraska. None in Nebraska. There's no one on death row today that anyone claims is innocent. There's no one who has been executed in Nebraska who anyone claims was innocent. With this exception, in 1897, there's a claim that there was a gentleman who was hung in Nebraska, and the claim is that he was innocent. But since 1897, there isn't even a claim that anyone has been innocent. So the question of innocence is we have to take a look at what happens in our state. And then when you take a look at what's happened across the country and you have these examples of others, well, maybe there are 156 people that are claimed to have been exonerated, but what for 90% of those people, it isn't that they were found innocent. It's that a court concluded that the evidence was not sufficient. That's a lot different than saying, well, we know they're innocent. But I can't justify the Jim Crow South. I cannot justify the corruption of other states. This is a state issue for our state, and what I can tell you is in our state, we have never executed an innocent person.
So, Bob's right. There's a lot of
stop
people
right there.
let me finish. there are a lot of people walking around this country today who are sentenced to death and are no longer under that sentence because DNA exonerated them. We know that. That's a big risk. It's a big risk. I think your claim that no one in our system is claiming innocence, maybe I think there's one guy who's saying he didn't do it. But I can't give you his name, so I won't go any further on that. But there is a guy that is walking around today that was on death row, and he was exonerated. How close he was to being executed, I don't know. But he was there. This happens. And it's a risk. And it's a risk that many of us in the legislature, we talked about it. Is this a risk we're willing to take? I've met people who have spent time on death row that were close to execution, and then DNA exonerated them. Criminal justice is full of people. So it's full of fallible humans. That's the system. Can't improve on that. We're not going to have robots do sentences. But because we have a fallible system, mistakes can be made. And it was the, and it is that risk that weighed on many of our minds, whether or not this is a punishment we ought to have on our, in our books. I'll leave it at that.
Here's a question for Senator Koash. I've seen studies that show a deterrent effect to the death penalty. Has there ever seen an independent analysis of all the deterrent studies?
Okay, so there's a couple of studies out there. Well, there's lots of studies, and you can research is robust in this. The Stanford study that Mr. Edmund referenced came out in 2005. Those authors published that study, but they also came back out a few years later. 2010, 5 years later, those very same authors published an article in the Stanford Review, and they said, and I'm going to quote from their review, "We do not know whether deterrence has been shown, nor do we conclude that the evidence of deterrence has reached some threshold of reliability." In 2012, the National Research Council reviewed comprehensively 3 decades of research and found no credible evidence that the death penalty deters. And I'm not surprised by that. Because I think common sense would tell us that. Common sense would tell us, in my opinion, and I think the studies bear this out, saying that the death penalty deters gives way too much credit to the people who would commit these crimes in the first place. It gives them credit for brains that they obviously don't have. If they could think through whether or not this crime I'm about to commit might get me the death penalty, they're smart enough not to commit the crime in the first place, and I just don't give them that kind of credit.
Okay. Well, I think you're selling them short. I don't know what article you're referring to in a Stanford Law Review. That was the article I referenced was from 2 law school professors who didn't do deterrent research. They relied on deterrent research that I described. The 2 authors of the statistical study reaffirmed their results, I don't know, in 2011 or 2012. And this compendium review was performed by a guy who has a dog in a hunt. He had a stake in the outcome because he sits in a chair. He gets money from an endowed chair that's endowed by a charitable organization that is anti-death penalty. And in addition to that, his own research would be called into question if a strong demonstration of death penalty deterrence could be made. So I don't consider him to be an honest broker when it comes to evaluating deterrent studies.
Next question. If the death penalty is upheld, where will the state get the drugs? And also to piggyback on that is how can Texas get the lethal drugs that they use? Senator?
Sure. So the first question is, where could we get the drugs? Well, we know where we went. We went to some shady guy in India who disappeared. I don't know. I would assume if there was an easier way to get the drugs, we wouldn't have had to go to India to do that. If there was a vendor across the street, across the country that would sell them to us, I'm sure our governor would have rather have done that than do what he did. But your second question is, how can Texas do this? And that is a fair question, and it is a question that I've had to answer repeatedly, And I've had to answer it. I had to answer it to my colleagues during this debate, because that's a fair question. People would come to me and say, Senator Kohash, Texas is doing it. Missouri's doing it. Florida's doing it. Well, let me tell you what's different about those states that are doing it, because I felt a duty to find out. Because I was out there saying it's a broken system, and people were saying, well, let's fix it. Here's how those states fixed it. They took everything having to do with the death penalty, and they shielded it, and they gave it immunity. And they said, you know what? We're not going to let the citizens know. We're not going to let the press know how we're doing it, where we're doing it, where we're getting the drugs. And it's not to protect the pharmacist. It's to protect the government from lying. Because with those laws, the government can lie. They can go to those drug vendors and say, oh, well, you know, we just want these drugs. And the drug maker will ask a very fair question, what are you going to use this drug for? And the government says, you know, I'm sorry. State law says I can't tell you. I can just buy them. But don't worry, if you sell them to me, you're protected. That's what Texas does. And that's a pretty high burden, high price to pay, in my opinion. And in the 8 years I served on the Judiciary Committee, and in the decades before that, not one senator has ever brought a bill saying, you know what, let's hide some stuff from our citizens so we can get executions going again. My colleagues understand what Nebraska would say about that. They understand that if they bring a bill that says we're going to shield the citizens from what its government is doing on something that is this high of stakes, what else will they shield them from? And that's why not one of my colleagues, even the most ardent supporters of the death penalty, and there are some, I've served with them, they're good men and women, but they were unwilling to bring that bill. They're unwilling to go down the Texas route because they're unwilling to hide it from the citizens. So they won't do it. So that's how you get executions to happen. You shroud it in secrecy. You shield it. And it was a price too high to bear for my colleagues who wanted to see executions.
Texas didn't have a shield law until about 3 or 4 years ago. And the reason that Texas adopted a shield law is because the pharmacists who provided the drugs to the state were being harassed constantly, intensely, by anti-death penalty people. And so that was what Texas adopted a shield law in response to that problem. It didn't have a shield law until 3 or 4 years ago. If you have a shield law that says that the identity of the pharmacist who provides the drugs to the state is kept confidential, I don't think that the citizens of the state are going to be up in arms about that. Now, Senator Kohash didn't try it. I don't know what his other colleagues did or didn't want to do, but that is one way that you can address the question of getting drugs provided. And, you know, the identity of, well, let me just leave it at that. The shield law is a way of protecting the pharmacist who provides the drugs. That's all.
Next question is, as previously stated, life sentences can be reduced to a set number, which makes parole possible. What parameters, if this is retained, would stop, what would make life mean life in prison, Senator?
Mr. Evanen mentioned this in his opening. We have a pardons board. It's the governor, the attorney general, and the secretary of state. That pardons board is set forth in the Constitution, not in statute. To me, that tells me it's pretty important. You put something in the Constitution, you hold it up a little bit, because it's more difficult to change a Constitution than it is a law. But our pardons board is up there in the Constitution, and it was there. It's been there for decades. The idea that these three statewide elected officials all of a sudden have some power now that they didn't have before is incorrect. They've had that commutation power decades before LB 268, regardless of the outcome of this vote this fall, they will have that power moving forward. It's been used three times in the last several decades. It's rarely used, as it should be. But if you believe that it's only available in life without parole cases, that's incorrect as well. The Pardons Board can change a sentence of death, they can change a sentence of life, they can change a sentence of years. And if you're worried that they're just going to start undoing all of these sentences, you have to ask, well, who did we put in office? Which one of the 10 people on death row do you think those three are going to let out? I don't see it happening. And they get held accountable for those decisions. And if you believe that it's available for all crimes, then we don't have a sentence for any crime, because the Pardons Board can just let anybody out. But they don't do that. They use it in very rare cases. I'll leave it at that.
Well, what Colby has said is, yes, you're right. Life doesn't mean life because the Pardons Board can commute the sentence. The fact that it could, it's not a point that I'm making. The point that's being made to the voters of Nebraska, which is not correct, is that the alternative to the death penalty is life in prison without parole. And what Colby has just given us a discussion of is that is not correct, because the Pardons Board can do something about it. And it has. It has the power to do so, and it's done so. The idea that it's rarely used, you go tell that to the family of the 10-year-old girl that Laddie Dittrich sexually assaulted. It was 100% for her. But that isn't the only reason why life doesn't mean life. The other reason is because the defense bar, the criminal defense bar, is constantly whittling away at the idea of life in prison without parole. Their theory is, both under the Nebraska Constitution and the federal Constitution, they're not going to go away. And we have this idea that if we just give up the death penalty, this whole litigation machine, all these people, will pull up stakes, fold their tents, go home and go fishing. And that is not what's going to happen. The next threshold for them is life without parole. They are constantly arguing that life without parole itself is unconstitutional. It's very cavalier to me. This is a point in this campaign that I think is really cavalier, kind of callous. And that is to claim, well, the alternative to the death penalty is life, when the people who are telling us that know that the lawyers who stand shoulder to shoulder with them are trying to eliminate life as a constitutional punishment right now. And that's the other reason why the statement, well, the alternative to the death penalty is life, is not accurate, not complete, and in my view, pretty cavalier.
Okay. This is going to be our last question. This is addressed to Senator Koash. Why didn't you want the amendment to allow the voters of Nebraska to vote on the death bill?
Sure. So in the debate last year, there was an amendment put forward that would take this issue and punt it to the voters. To understand how the legislature dealt with that, you kind of have to understand how the legislature looks at its role. I have never seen, this was the first example through this amendment, where a law was punted to the voters from the legislature. The regular way that it would work, that it has worked, is that a constitutional amendment, if you're changing the Constitution, the legislature can move that language to the vote, to a vote of the people. But never does a law go to the vote of the people. And I did understand why people put that up, but here's what went through my mind. I can only speak for myself. I was sent to the Capitol to make tough decisions. and I had to make a lot of them. This was just one of a many tough decisions that I had to make in my 8 years in the legislature. And if every time I wanted to avoid a tough decision, I decided to just, well, let's let the people decide, I don't think that would have been doing what I was sent there to do. There's two ways that things get to the people. One is through a constitutional amendment that the legislature puts to them on the ballot, or, as the reason we're here today, the people can organize and put it on the ballot themselves. That is the way that it's happened. But for me to say to my constituents, you know what, I'm uncomfortable making this decision, let's put this on the ballot on an issue of crime and punishment, albeit a weighty issue, an emotional issue, I wasn't willing to do that. I wasn't willing to punt my responsibility as a legislator and saying, I don't care to make a tough decision, so I'm going to put this vote to the people. That's my answer.
Thank you.
Go ahead. You know, this is, I'll decide, you'll be fine. This is I'm not going to be critical of the unicameral, but the unicameral made a very big mistake on a very large issue. And now 166,000 Nebraskans signed petitions all across the state, every county, to put this on the ballot. Enough signatures to stop the repeal from going into effect and to put it on the ballot. So now the voters, even though that amendment was defeated, the amendment that Kobe voted against was defeated. The voters in Nebraska are going to have an opportunity to vote on this in November, and if you get early voting, it'll start in October. And so if you want to keep the death penalty, then on your ballot you'll vote to repeal. You'll be voting to repeal the legislature's repeal in order to keep the death penalty. So thank you.
We'd like to thank both gentlemen, Senator Colby Koash and Attorney Robert Evnen, for attending our noon forum this afternoon.
You've been listening to a special luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a debate on the initiative which will appear on the Nebraska ballot on next Tuesday's general election, giving the voters the choice of restoring capital punishment in Nebraska or sustaining the legislature's action of May 2015, banning the death penalty in Nebraska. The participants were Colby Koash, co-chairman of Retain a Just Nebraska, and Robert Evnen, co-founder of Nebraskans for the Death Penalty. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, September 15th, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. As the participants emphasized, a vote to repeal the legislature's action will be a vote to retain the death penalty in Nebraska. Listen tomorrow, November 4th at 12 noon, for the second of these two special election programs from the Omaha Press Club. We'll hear a debate between the two candidates for Congress from Nebraska's 2nd District, incumbent Democrat Brad Ashford, seeking his second term in office, and challenger Republican Don Bacon, seeking to unseat Mr. Ashford. The recording engineer for today's program was Mike Hansen. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.